Captain Wright, relate. You were saying you constructed an observation post on the Rewisat Ridge.
Yes, being rock, we had to blast it out, and so south of Dill. I went up, we had to do it at night, of course, and I went up either the next morning or sometime later to see how effective it was. And I remember getting there and seeing some Germans. I don't know, can't remember quite what they were doing, whether they were... There were three of them, and they were either knocking pickets in or sighting a mortar or something. I can't think they'd have sighted it in the open air, but open ground. But anyway, the artillery officer thought that they were worth hitting, so down came this lot, 25 pounders. And of course, everything was obliterated. And I somehow felt a twinge of conscience about that. I don't know whether it was the remoteness or something, but or the fact that I'd been instrumental in the chaps copying it. But I did feel a twinge of pity, I suppose, really. I thought, oh dear, what a pity. But I think with the Japanese, quite different.
What sort of training did you do for Burma before you went into that country?
We did it in a place called Ranchi, was it? In India, which had a sort of almost jungle there. And I think we did a number of operations involving 6-pounder anti-tank guns for blasting bunkers.
That sounds like tactical training, really.
Tactical, yes. Well, I think we got a pretty good idea of how things were going to be from our divisional commander. I think, I forget whether he was the first to remark upon this, but he, within a very short time of getting there, he got hold of the idea that the form of defensive Japanese work were these bunkers with a thick top to them, so they were artillery proof, and mutually defensive. In other words, unlike the pillboxes we scattered all over this country, they were defended behind them by the adjoining bunkers. There were always three, as far as I can remember. And so we had the idea of keeping the heads down of all three while we went in and blew one of them up. I think that was the general tenor of our training. It was at sort of platoon level with supporting arms, I think.
How would you go about keeping the heads down? Would this be a role for the 6-pounders, or would this be...
Oh, machine gun. Bren, largely.
Bren.
Yes. Yes.
What would the 6-pounders' role be? Would it be to...
Well, that was to get rid of the top hamper. And I mean, it would bring the whole lot down. I can remember one unforgettable thing when we were in the Arakan. It wasn't our division, it was 7th Indian Division next door, but we had a hand in getting a 3-7 Akak gun up the Nakedok Pass. And I always feel we should have used them in the same role in the Western Desert. They were very like an English version, a version of the 88mm. And this thing, when it was in place, lowered its barrel and sights, and there was this whopping great bunker in front, dug right into the hillside, and it put about 5 rounds into that, and there was just a heap of earth there in the end.
What sort of range was it firing at to do that job?
Oh. Just under half a mile, I suppose, something like that.
It's a considerable distance.
Oh, yes. But then for an ACAT gun, that's nothing, is it?
What about the six-pounder? How close would you get to the bunker with a six-pounder in order to wreck it?
Well, of course, I never experienced that. All we did was do it in theory in India. I can't ever remember seeing a six-pounder do anything like that, because the range would be less, and the topography really made it very difficult to get them in. And I suppose what we did in the end was to use 75-pounders from tanks.
Did you do any training specifically for jungle operations at Ranchi or any other part of India before going in?
Oh, yes, of course, yes, we did. We used to build mule tracks, that's right, yes. We had to zigzag these mule tracks up the side of a hill. And we had a thing, we had some wonderful equipment in a way. We had some dreadful equipment too, but we had a thing called a Delisle pendant. And this was a survey instrument, really. You dangled it from your thumb and finger of your left hand and gazed through it and adjusted various things. It would give you show you a gradient. I think, what was the maximum gradient for a mule? It's 1 in 7 or something like that. It was fairly steep. And you'd keep these mule tracks below that figure and zigzag them up the side of a hill. It was a pretty uninteresting task, but it was very, very necessary. And mules were lifeblood, really, to us.
How wide would a mule track have to be practicable?
Ah, yes. Well, it would have to be, from the undergrowth, I suppose, at least 3'6", 4', because of the loads they had to carry. But I can remember following a mule somewhere in Burma. We were moving from A to B, and this thing had number 9 set, I think it was. Terribly valuable long-distance radio transmitter, and it had 2 bloody great big boxes, one on either side of it, I suppose. And it was a side cut, and along a hill, the side of a hill, and I can remember being half asleep and seeing this thing bouncing around in front of me and very little distance behind, and suddenly it disappeared over the side. And I thought, well, so much for the sure-footedness of mules. So I dashed down through the undergrowth and came to a clearing down below, and this thing bucked its load off and was quietly cropping the grass there. I can't help feeling it was all deliberate. Whether the radio worked again, I don't know, but it exploded any idea of the sure-footedness of mules.
Did you have to have them in your own unit?
No, no, we got them from transport companies.
Oh.
I mean, they'd be allocated to us for a particular operation, so many mules, but I have to say that whether due to enemy action casualties or just sickness or something, we lost a lot of mules, and we had to reduce our our supply demands a lot. So for quite a time, I can remember, like about 6 weeks or so, a couple of months maybe, we had no officers' mess at all. So we lived on the same rations as our Jawans, as we call them, our troops. And to this day, unless I have dal and chapatis every now and again, I get sort of withdrawal symptoms, I think.
Were there any changes made to your establishment or scale of equipment or type of equipment before you went into Burma?
Oh, indeed, indeed, yes. Whereas in the desert we were very mobile. In the jungle we weren't. We had very little transport, and we had everything was much more. I can remember our colonel, wonderful chap, Colonel Napier, Uncle Arthur, as we used to call him. He was a descendant of the great Lord Napier, and he came to watch our training in India. I was the only officer present. Everybody else was on leave or something, and I can remember him, when he looked at what was going on, saying, yes, yes, you've got the idea. We're no longer in the realm of modern warfare. We're back to the concept of fascines and gabions and shako hats and all that sort of thing. And I thought, what a wonderful summary of the metamorphosis from one to the other.
What was your first intrusion into Burma then? You joined the 14th Army, I think, September 43. Where did you go first?
Well, the first job I had to do was as rear link to the division and the supporting troops, I suppose. I had to run a ferry, I think it was a folding boat ferry, across quite a wide estuary. I think the place was called Bawli, Bawli. And we ferried everything except tanks across. I forget. Yes, the tanks came down a lot later. And we could take everything else, workshop trucks and three-tonners. And
what kind of vessel did you have? Was it a powered raft or...?
A powered raft, yeah. Yes. Two folding boats which went on the back of a truck and folded inwards, except when it was in the water it folded outwards. Mm. Road bearers and decking, and then sort of open boats sticking beyond the carriageway, you see. Mm. Yes, I had a memorable experience there, which is on the same lines as my previous discussions of senior officers. I got a signal from no less than the divisional commander himself saying that we were due to get a visit from the Supreme Commander of Southeast Asia. Great honour, because we were the first division he visited. And being the rear link of the division, this ferry would be the meeting point between General Briggs and Admiral Lord Mountbatten. And I was told that I'd have everything ready and all the rest of it, you see, so what particular time and this, that and the other. So I did this. I looked up King's regulations and I found out the form for saluting flag officers. And the nearest I could do was to scrub all the decks until they were sort of, I don't know, we didn't have holy stone, but we made them look pretty clean. To polish all the brass there was quite a lot of that. And we couldn't toss oars because we were powered, but we had boat hooks. So we did this drill and we tossed our boat hooks, which were brass at the end, and it looked very smart, at least I thought so. So, in due course, the time arrived, and I'd briefed my troops in Urdu what was to happen, you see, and I told them the General Sahib would arrive on the south bank at 1000 hours, and at 10:05 we'd take him across to the north bank. The Admiral Sahib would arrive at 10:15, and they would meet each other, and we'd walk down behind his transport onto the ferry and we go across. What I hadn't bargained for was the fact that Lord Mountbatten always took an enormous retinue with him. And in due course, we tied up at the North Bank and Mountbatten arrived on time. He had about four jeeps all crammed with wrens and all the rest of it. I mean, it was quite a spectacular affair. I think he was given very much to ceremony. And so the General Briggs went up and saluted and they shook hands and it turned around and came to me and I saluted and shook hands and was introduced. And we walked down behind his jeep and as soon as we were on the raft, raft connections were pulled out and off we went, you see. It was quite a current there. It was a tidal creek, tidal estuary. And we shot downstream. And the Admiral turned around to me and he said, look, he said, I'm terribly sorry, but we've got to go back. I've got an enormous retinue, you see. It's something I'd already realised by then. So back we went and we threw the breast lines in and the raft connectors went in. And in due course, the three remaining vehicles came on and we set off again. And we went down to the south bank, breasted the current, came up through the breast lines ashore and we were pulled in and we dropped the raft connectors in. Whereupon Lord Louis turned round to me and said, bloody good. He said, try a bit harder and you'll be almost as good as the Royal Navy. And I thought I'd go to hell for that chap. I thought he was wonderful.
What sort of power had you got on this raft then? Was it an outboard system?
I think it had a yes, it had a flexible drive down to which went over the side of the boat, and there was a I don't know, 4-horsepower engine. No, 4 must be more. What am I talking about? I don't know. There was a standard bit of army kit that drove this. I forget whether it was air-cooled, but it was quite a substantial thing, and it you put a sort of assembly of a propeller over the side and secured it to the side of the boat, and I suppose there must have been a rudder behind it as well. It was like a sort of outboard motor, but the motor was in the boat.
Had you actually had to build this raft as well as operate it?
Oh, indeed, yes. I mean, like all that army stuff, you just sort of got the parts and you jammed them all in together, and there was a drill to do it. And there was standard stuff. I suppose we must have done quite a lot of that in our training in India as well, yes.
Did you have just the one raft on that route across the estuary, or did you have more than one?
That's a point. I think we probably had more than one. Yes, I can't imagine we'd only have one. Yes, I think we probably had at least two.
How many men would you need to operate such a system? You'd have chaps on the raft itself, and then at each end of the...
Oh, you'd have half a dozen, about, I suppose, yes. Mm. Well, 8 or 9, I'd say, yes. Mm.
And you said you couldn't carry tanks on it, but you could carry virtually everything but tanks.
Well, Bren gun carriers and... I forget how the tanks... Well, later on, I suppose we had a... Yes, later on, we had a proper pontoon bridge. I forget what we call the pontoon bridge. It was like an upmarket folding boat bridge. Mm. Folding boat bridge, well, they were both assault bridges, I suppose, yes. But it had a higher leg capacity. Mm. And we had the first Shermans in, I think. Yes.
Well, there were Shermans that went in with 7th Indian Division, I think, 25th Dragoons.
Oh, yes, right, yes.
And they went over the pass as well.
Yes. That's right.
How many men, then, could you get onto this ferry if you wanted to get the maximum number on to get them across the river.
About the size of this room, I suppose. Mm. Not much more. A bit longer.
Yeah. You get a platoon on, then quite... You pack them
together. Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. Yes. Mm. And they could go in the boats as well, being mobile.
And that would take you, what, about 10 minutes to get across from one side to the other?
About that, yes. Yeah.
So it was your first job, and that was really at divisional level then. You were effectively...
Indeed, yes. 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 Oh, excuse me. Yes.
And the capacity of the ferry was about a platoon.
That's right, yes.
Strength. How long were you doing that job?
Oh, 3 weeks, probably.
And was the ferry going backwards and forwards constantly, or did it just go on demand?
Oh, it went on demand, I think. Yes, yes, it would, yes. Which was fairly constant. It was largely one way.
Could you work it at night, or was it just for daytime operation?
No, we didn't work it at night. I suppose we could have done, but no, we didn't. I was doing a bit of road building at the same time.
Was that on the approaches to the ferry?
Well, further down, because once it was operating, there was no point in my being there, really, because the chap was quite capable of running it. Now, we had an earth road, and I was trying to keep the dust down using local labour. In fact, that brings me to another recollection about my senior officers. We were employing whole families of local people, throwing water from the paddy fields, which they've been harvested already, but the water was still there, and they'd throw it up onto this Bund Road. And I was inspecting all this and seeing that they did their job, which they seldom did. And I ran out of transport. My jeep, the one that had been hit by the Vickers Valencia, went on the blink, and I had to have some transport. And I went to the mountain battery, because they had chargers there, you see. And I said, could they loan me a charger? So they agreed, and in due course I went to collect my mount, and it was presented to me with all the army kit on board. I mean, it had its spare shoes hanging down from the cantle of the saddle, and it had its spare blanket or whatever rolled up behind it, and it had this and that and the other, including a sword sheath, and I think, yes, it was a sword in it, that's right. And so I climbed onto this thing and trotted down the road, and I suddenly thought, well, if they see me coming, they'll all sort of leap up and pretend they've been doing work. And so I thought I'd make a crafty approach. I went across some paddy fields into the jungle, over the local the sort of feature there, there was a small hill or something, came down the other side onto more paddy, and there they were, all sitting down doing nothing, you see. And so I took my steed to the point where the jungle ended. It was secondary jungle, and which concealed me, you see. And then when I came to the paddy field, dry, well, fairly dry, paddy field, I sucked my heels into the horse, and off we went. And off we went, at a fast canter, or gallop, I think, across the paddy field. And these people didn't seem to move, and so I took the sword out and waved it around, you see, and yelled. And as I came up to the road, I found that my arrival at that particular spot coincided with a jeep, which had just come round the brow of the hill, and the Jeep had a flag on it, which disturbed me a bit. And it denoted the CRA, Commander Royal Artillery. Wonderful chap called Brigadier Mansour. And Bob Mansour, wonderful fellow. He knew the name of practically every officer in the whole division, which must have been about 800, I think. And as we pulled up, the driver, who was a bombardier, I think, was looking straight ahead in an impassive, or assumed an impassive way, which more or less said, I've got nothing to do with this. And old Bob Mansour leaned across and said, morning, Wright. He said, is this the accepted practice of the Corps of Royal Engineers for road labour inspection? And I felt about 2 inches high, but it got them up on their feet anyway.
How did you recruit these people, local?
That's a point. Yes, I don't quite know how I did that. I suppose through the divisional staff somehow. I don't know. I didn't go around sort of touting for labour, but I'm sorry, I don't know.
And what were they supposed to be doing? Was it just putting water on the road to lay the dust?
Exactly, just that, yes. To lay the dust, yes. And, I mean, it was a subsistence for them, so that was all right.
Mm. Roughly how many of them do you think you had on your road gangs?
About 100 or so, I expect, yes. Well, that was for the whole length of the road, yes.
Mm. And what sort of, how long was the road, the stretch of road you were looking after?
12 miles, a bit more, I can't remember.
And were they having to do this every day, chuck water?
That's right, yes.
How did they fetch and carry it? Was it just a matter of carrying buckets from paddy to the...
Well, they chucked it on from cigarette tins, which wasn't very hard work.
Mm. What happened then next? You were on this ferry and road, providing line of communication to Rear Link. What's your next job after that?
Next job after that was the first battle I was in. It was called North Arakan, and I was under command of the battalion commander of the 4th 7th Rajputs. And a wonderful regiment. They, incidentally, I think, were the first troops to fire a shot in anger at the Axis troops under General O'Connor in the Western Desert in 1940. But they were regular and they were splendid people. And we kicked off by patrolling, which, as I said earlier, wasn't a very agreeable pastime.
How many sappers did you take with you on this duty?
Oh, the whole section, about 70-odd men.
So it was you plus a section attached to the 4th, 7th Rajputs.
Yes, and he gave me orders about what... Yeah. Well, he didn't give me orders, but he said, I want this done and that done, and I'd do it.
And was there anybody else attached to them as a battalion?
To the battalion?
Yes.
Well, they'd probably have a forward observation officer from the artillery. Who else would they have? I don't quite know. I think I was the only operational bloke with them. I think so, yes.
And you were working directly for their colonel, so you're under command?
That's right, under command, yes, which is a very agreeable situation, because I